Cool. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming today. Before I introduce our guest, first I always like to remind everybody, please turn off your cell phones or at least put them on mute now. I believe we've already done so or doing so at the head table, but we do record these now. We put them up on the web, and it's very irritating for people. They just as the speaker gives that really pithy quote and you get a beep, 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 and you can't quite make out what they said. So please do all turn off your phones now. With that, I'd like to very briefly introduce Chandran Iyer. He asks that we keep it very brief, and we'll let you try to see where he really stands on the issues. I'm not going to summarize them for him. His book has grabbed a lot of attention. He's been on the road almost continuously from Europe last week to Australia coming up in the next few days, really trying to and succeeding in sparking a debate on the sustainability of current patterns of global consumption, particularly with rising consumption in Asia. And with that, Mr. Nair.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Was the fish okay? Yeah, okay. I've got about 20 minutes, I'm told, and some of you who know me will know that I can talk for too long. What I'm going to do is try and capture the essence of the arguments that I've outlined in the book. I have to tell you, the book's doing quite well, but what I have to say is quite hard. So I hope you'll all not jump to conclusions and tolerate some of my belligerence. But what I'm trying to do is, essentially, in a way, slay cows in front of Brahmins. So if there are any Brahmins amongst you, please, no jihad. Just behave yourselves. I'm also trying to kind of mainstream a discussion that I think for far too long has been ignored. And that is the issue of limits and constraints, particularly in business and political forums, and Hong Kong being that mega center of a spin around what's happening in the world. If you talk about limits, you're instant pariah. So what I've tried to do with the book is to mainstream what I think is the political challenge of our times. So I'll try and say what I have to say in three bits. First, what triggered me writing the book, then what the book says and what it doesn't say, and hopefully a bit about what I hope the book will achieve. So why did I write the book? I've been working in this area of sustainability and the environment for about 25 years. And I've been thinking a lot about what would happen eventually if Asia actually started to grow. This was 20 years ago. And at that time, we were still laggards, not growing that much, et cetera. At the same time, there was a lot of discussion over the last few years about sustainability, corporate social responsibility, et cetera, which, having worked with some of the biggest companies, I began to understand, really didn't get to the core of the issue. So let me give you an example, for instance. The term sustainable development now has become a sort of catchphrase for everything, a lot of public relations. Let me get really into it. Even the U.S. Army has got a sustainable development policy. I have no idea what that means. I don't know if you have, but I have suggested maybe it's a carbon neutral Guantanamo Bay, stuff like that. It's very interesting. Then we have the term greening these days as well, which has become a sort of nice way to pretend that we will fix the problem. Let me give you an example of this sort of public relations exercise. So we have greening, we have sustainable development, etc. In my view, if there was a public relations industry about 250 years ago, slaves would have been called migrant workers. They would have been guest workers, things like that. They wouldn't have been called slaves. That's where we are. We are greening things, we are sustainable development, etc. And I think we need to really get to the crux of the matter, which is, we live on a planet, and this is not an environmental discussion, we live on a planet with limited resources, period. And we are at a stage where human population has reached 6.5 billion, and expected to reach about 9 billion people. Public relations and dodging the bullet will not get us to where we need to be. And all I wanted to do after spending so many years working in this area with policymakers, et cetera, was to say, can we talk about this more honestly? Intellectual dishonesty, in my view, is the biggest risk of our times. And that intellectual dishonesty is pervasive at every global forum, at policymakers' forums, and absolutely at business forums. So I felt there was a need for a different narrative, a narrative that would come out of Asia. And if I was able to say this well enough and articulate it, I was hoping that the narrative would change, that we would not have the Thomas Friedman flat world society suggesting that somehow we will fix this problem because there'll be some genius from Silicon Valley or these days from Bangalore who will find a way to make things happen. That we could eat all, we could consume all the tuna in the ocean, but there'd be some genius and with venture capital to grow tunas in a laboratory in a Petri dish. This will not happen. And that's what I wanted this discussion to be about. So that's why I wrote the book. It's not a doomsday book, by the way. I think those who are pretending that we can solve this problem with technology, free markets, and finance, those are the ones who are writing the script for doomsday. I think we need to say, let's look at this in the mirror, confront it, and decide what we're going to do. Because confronting this issue will be the political challenge of the 21st century, and it ultimately means limiting what you and I can have. I'm putting it very crudely, but deciding what you and I can have. So if some have suggested that maybe I am ranting against the Western economic model, I do suggest in the book that Asia, and I'm not suggesting Asia will do this, will need to reject the Western consumption-led economic model, which has essentially been the mantra in the post sort of Second World War era. You know, in this part of the world, post-colonization, et cetera, there was only one thing on the menu, and that was the Western economic model, sometimes called the Washington Consensus. We will need to reject this. But it's not a rant against the West. If anything, it's a rant against Asian policymakers and business leaders who are asleep at the wheel, following an economic model that many of them know is failing, but hope somewhere, somehow, someone will find solutions to. So what does the book say? In 2050, there will be about 5 billion Asians. That would be about 60% of the world population. So imagine a world of 5 billion Asians, all aspiring to live like Americans. You do not need to be a climate change denial. You do not need to be a rocket scientist to know game over. This is not going to happen. Instead, what we have is some sort of view that we will find solutions to all of this, head in the sand, and let's hope for the best. That is not a plan. Hope is not a plan. We need to think very differently. And I'll give you one example of why we need to think very differently. The car is often seen as the engine of growth in most developing countries. And currently, Asia is where most of the car industry is looking for growth, yes? Today in the OECD countries, there's something like 800 cars per 1,000 people. China is already the world's largest car market. Any guesses how many cars in China per 1,000 people? There's about 150 cars per 1,000 people in China, the world's largest car market. In India, the car population is about 30 per 1,000. Indians haven't even started driving. The good thing in India is the government will never build good roads, and so we might have a low car population anyway. So it might be a strategic positioning that the Indian government has on limiting car ownerships without telling the car companies, you can't sell your cars here. But that's what it is. Now, if Indians and Chinese, and then you add the Indonesians and the Vietnamese and et cetera, start aspiring to car ownership levels like the OECD countries, there will be 3 billion passenger cars in the world. Today there are about 800 million, four times. This is not going to happen. Imagine a world with 3 billion cars. Most of you who live in the Hong Kong, who vacation in Asia, will know most of our cities are dumps. We need more cars, like I need a hole in my head. Yeah? So we will need to do something very, very different. But instead, we have science fiction around green cars, electric cars, hybrids, etc. This is not going to happen either. From rare earths to the cost of producing all of these things, we'd be very lucky if in Asia in the next 20 years we have even 20 million green cars. Germany today is the most advanced automotive nation in Europe, and the German government has suggested that they want 1 million green cars by 2020. Do you know how many green cars there are in Germany today? I was in Germany just on Sunday speaking to an audience in Berlin. There are less than 5,000. This is not going to happen. I've spoken at the board room of one of the largest car supply, the largest car supply spare parts manufacturer in all the, in the entire world, and they agree with me this is not going to happen for a whole host of interests, a whole host of reasons, mainly because of sunk cost, invested interest, etc. And I can go on about chickens, meat consumption, to iPads, to mobile phones. But let me just give you one more example, which is my favorite, which is the mobile phone. Where's my mobile phone? Okay, switched off. This mobile phone in Hong Kong, today you go to a shop run by a Mr. Lee and you get it for free. True? But you then have to sign up to a 2-3 year contract. This mobile phone, as you will all know, is hydrocarbon intensive, made from hydrocarbons, plastic, rare earths, all kinds of exotic metals, hugely costly to make, but we get it for free. My principal point is, we have a system of economic growth and development based on externalizing costs. The burden has shifted to wherever we can do it. We all blame China for its pollution, but essentially China has just become the laundering outlet for production of production and underpricing of true costs. This mobile phone should cost you about $5,000 if you put in the true price. Then, you know, 10-year-old kids will not be walking around with mobile phones because it'll not be easy to have a mobile phone. And I can go on about Apples and iPads and stuff like that as well. The underpricing of everything has taken us to this point. So when I was in Europe last week, someone said to me, the problem is the Europeans were talking about, you know, all the convulsions in the financial markets. The Greek foreign minister was there, and they said, you know, the last 30 years has been terrible. We've over-leveraged. It was my turn to speak. I said, take 30 and multiply it by 10. 300 years of over-leveraging, starting with slavery, colonialism, then free markets, then globalization, financial leveraging, etc. Essentially, we have underpriced everything. And this is not a political rant about colonialism, but if you look at colonialism, what was colonialism? Just like slavery was an attempt to underprice resources, and then it became immoral, colonialism was an attempt to underprice everything, access to resources. Then we migrated. But we are at, in my view, the sort of end of an era of human development, I don't want to call it progress, where essentially development was achieved through underpricing everything. Now we have to rethink. So in Asia, my view is we have to think differently. Now, I'm sure most of you were thinking, my God, you're trusting Asian governments, will they do this? I have no idea if they will do it. But what I have tried to do is to say, can we have the more honest conversation? And that conversation, therefore, will start with, in my view, putting resource management and maybe moving it away from an environmental discussion where as soon as I say I'm an environmentalist, you know, most people are thinking, hey, he has granola for breakfast, he smokes a bit of pot, he's got sandals, tie-dye t-shirt, and he's trying to save dolphins. I'm not that one of those types, okay? But this is an issue about the future of our civilization, because we've underpriced everything. So the point I want to make is there's three key policy areas, but overarching it is that we have to put resource issues at the center of all policies. Why? I can lose this my little gadget here, and I will live quite happily. In fact, I may lead even slightly happier lives without emails, etc. But much of our focus is on the stuff that will give us things that really do not sustain us. And again, I want to be very clear, I'm not an environmentalist. But you and I, someone's leaving already, bit hardcore. financial services, I suspect. But But you and I depend on our existence on the productivity of natural systems. And natural systems everywhere are being threatened. It's not an environmental discussion. It's about how we, you and I, survive on the underpricing of the things that we take for granted, but have not paid a true price for. So natural resource management becomes the center of all policy making. Within that, I suggest three key areas that Asian government should focus on. How am I doing for time?
7 minutes.
Okay. First one is that we need to put, because resources are constrained, we will need to do one very important thing at the policy level, and that is make economic policy subservient to maintaining the vitality of natural resources. Fundamental change and shift in the way we think about economic policy. Subservient to maintaining the vitality of natural resources. This is not a Greenpeace message, please. Okay? Secondly, because resource issues need to be shared equitably between current and future generations, we will need to make collective welfare take precedence over individual rights. This flies in the face of much of sort of liberal democratic situations where the individual is king. So collective welfare before individual rights, and I can elaborate on that if people want to talk about it a bit more. And finally, and very importantly, we need to reprice resources. Repricing becomes very important because essentially capitalism today thrives on underpricing resources. And there's lots of research about, you know, for every dollar that we produce in GDP, we extract about $1.5 from the natural resource base. And essentially the coupons are all coming in. And carbon is just one example of where the coupons are coming in. So we need to reprice. But in repricing this, we have to reject some of the most fundamental core beliefs of the economic system that we've inherited essentially from the West. You know, the stuff that comes out of the stormtroopers of Wharton Business School, et cetera. And that is, how do we measure productivity? And productivity, as you many of you know today, is measured around the notion that use as much resources as you can and use as few people as possible. It's called competitive advantage. You will know Foxconn, the largest producer of electronic parts, the guys who Steve Jobs employs to make cheap iPads, which really should cost about $10,000, by the way, have announced last week that they will be employing 1 million robots to produce Steve Jobs's iPads in a country where there's 1.3 billion people, where every year there's about 30 million people looking for work. Why? Upside down economics. Apparently, the cost of labor in China today is more than the cost of capital, upside down. But, you know, I'll let the geniuses of finance and economics figure out that. But productivity needs to be changed around resources rather than people. Why do I say that? 100 years ago, if you were a migrant to the USA, lots of resources. There were a few people that are called native Indians, kind of push them aside and then use all the resources. How do you do that? Few people, you create machines. It was called being productive. Our problem today, and particularly in this part of the world, is absolutely the opposite. We have lots of people and limited resources. We need to create jobs. We need to get people to do work slowly. And therefore, productivity needs to be around using as few resources as possible and making people work productively but slowly using as few resources as possible. So the entire equation needs to change. And I argue finally in the book, to do all of this, and this is where I suspect there'll be lots of questions, we need a strong state. That I know immediately gets some people thinking I'm some fascist Mussolini type or I'm a card-carrying member of the Chinese Communist Party. That is not what I'm suggesting. It could be democratic, but let's leave aside the ideological debates of the 20th century. If you believe, as I do, that the 21st century's primary political challenge will be access to resources for 9 billion people, then you have to understand that we need rules. We can't have a free-for-all. If we need rules, we need institutions. We can't have tea parties. I wish the Americans the best of luck with that little fun and games they're having at the moment. But that's not what we don't have that luxury. We need to have strong states. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm talking about a Chinese government model, etc. I don't have all the answers. But I think you will agree with me. If resource constraints is a 21st century political challenge, we need institutions, we need rules. As I said, we can't have more cars in Asian cities. Who's going to tell them? When I was in Germany last week, you know, some guy stood up and said, we need active citizenship. I said, why don't you start a movement suggesting that Germans would give up one car? Active citizenship doesn't do that, because we all behave badly. 20 years ago, you could probably smoke in this room. Today, you can't. 30 years ago, we could shoot elephants. Today, we can't. So we need rules. And I want to end by saying that, therefore, the role of the state, the institutions of the state, become fundamental to this debate. And at the moment, the last 30 years, we have had a trajectory suggesting, particularly out of the West, that, you know, the state needs to stay away. And business and commerce will take care of everything. And of course, we know where Wall Street got us. So I'll end with that and happy to take some questions. Thank you very much.
I'd like to take questions. Please, everybody, identify yourself. Why don't I start over here and then down here, please?
Hi, I'm Karen. And you know what? I'm interested because you say we. Who is we? Because you want the governments and the institutions. It's, I think what you're saying is excellent, and the content is superb. But in reality, I work in China. I'm going there this afternoon. I've been there for many years. I would like to really ask, but how do you want to engage such governments? Have you been speaking in China? What about India? Because these are the two major Asian countries we actually need to deal with, whoever the we is. Is there a coalition? Is there a group effort? What do you envision? Because in the future, as you well know, as you said, if we develop such tastes that cater to aspiring to American, what we call, okay, the good life, I agree, forget it. But China's well on the way. So okay. we have to address consumerism. And you can't stop people buying stuff. So
you can.
How?
Okay, so the we, I mean, I've been, you know, in 20 minutes, I've not gone into explaining all the details. Do by the book, I explain who the we is. But I broadly mean we, this part of the world, mainly because this part of the world is the majority of the world's population. In the next 50 years, the population of Europe and the USA will be less than 10% of the world's population. So you're absolutely right. China and India don't get this right. Basically, just hope for the best. Have a drink, have a party. How will this be done? I am very clear, I don't have all the answers. But what I have tried to do is embolden people in this part of the world who I believe have been intellectually subservient for 200 years. They have aspired and copied everything from the West. You know, we have economists today still talking about Adam Smith. Poor guy's been dead about 200 years. And if you're Asian and you've been here and you know where do the elite of this old world go? They all go to the Wharton Business Schools and come back learning an ideology and an ideology that's no more relevant. So all I've tried to do is say, let's have a new narrative. The good news is, you know, when the book came out, I had the Economic Times of India immediately seek an interview to have a narrative. And, you know, there was great response from economists in India as well. So I'm not trying to overstate the importance of the book, but one thing I've been very clear is no one's had this narrative. No one's tried to say we can do something different. The Chinese, I wrote a piece in the FT about 3-4 months ago, and within a day it was translated into Chinese, and there were bloggers talking about all of this. Clearly there's a conflict, there's going to be a huge fight, but I see the Chinese development as, and the Chinese version of the book is coming out in the next couple of months. All right, and that too suggests to me there's great interest. But I see the Chinese development as if you follow a soccer game, win the first 15 minutes of the first half. But if they don't get it right, the Indians don't get it right, the Indonesians don't get it right, then let's just, you know, wish for the best. Some people say, you know, God and stuff like that, but just wish for the best. But I'm more interested in actions to change the discourse.
Down here in the front, please.
Yes, thank you for a very interesting presentation. I'm Jane Singer with Inside Fashion Magazine. We cover the apparel and retail industry. So some of what you were saying, particularly about pricing, is very interesting because there's been a lot of discussion amongst our industry about that, particularly with rising raw material, labor costs, and so forth. how would you see the correct way to price a consumer item? You say that you believe things need to be repriced, that they're underpriced.
Sure. I mean, for one, we can start putting a carbon tax on most things. But let's just take the garment industry, which, you know, I've done some work through a program we do on leadership on cotton.
Okay.
I mean, cotton is, I'm not sure if you're aware, the most polluting crop in the entire planet. 2% of cultivated land on the planet, 18% of pesticides and herbicides. No single garment company pays a fraction of the cost of producing cotton. I'm not even talking about labor costs. I mean, Indian cotton is cheaper than Chinese cotton because it's essentially child labor. So, you know, companies could do something, but companies won't do it. The other point I make is that people talk about companies and sustainability. I mean, it's a silly discussion. Companies use the word sustainability and they're hanging themselves. The heart of the discussion about sustainability is the idea of less. Companies don't do less, they do more. It doesn't make them bad, but they should stop talking about that. They can be more efficient, but only governments can start to say, cotton, the true cost is so much, and put a price on pesticides per kilogram of cotton, and then start taxing the hell out of it.
But do you feel that that's a bit theoretical and that, you know, you can talk about it from a theoretical idea, but when you actually have to sit down and calculate pricing on this, it becomes a bit more difficult and
of course
and
it becomes
somewhat
difficult,
subjective.
But you know, if the genius of the finance industry can do all the mumbo-jumbo that they do, we can employ some of them, the smart guys, and get this done. Of course there's a theoretical element to it, but we can put a price to all of these things. Absolutely. The problem is, industry lobbies have become so powerful, they've usurped. I mean, I worked with, you know, oil and gas, all the industries, I know what goes on. They lobby and fight every rule, just like they fought here in Hong Kong against minimum wage for 10 years. And that's why if we allow industry to usurp governments, like, you know, News Corp, UK government, then we have no chance. I come back to my point, we need strong governments. Will governments stand up against industry interests? That's the challenge of our times.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, back over here, and then her next.
Eric Floyd, Osria Association for Sustainable and Responsible Investment in Asia. Chandran, I essentially agree with your view of the resource constraints and the big emphasis on externalities, so low pricing. But I wonder about your prescription, because you automatically jump to the assumption that it means big government. It's possible it has more to do with reform with how business operates, and perhaps more corporate business responsibility for what is now externalities. And the example I would give you is overfishing off of North America. And of course, because it's a free good, people overfish. The quota systems were dreadful failures because you didn't change the pricing. So everybody would get their quota, and then of course they would go around their quota because if they could get their hands on the fish, it was cheap and they made a lot of money. So suddenly it's working around North America because they shifted to effectively a property system where instead of having quotas, you lease areas of water and you own that water effectively. And so you suddenly care about those fish and you don't want them to be overfished because they're your fish. So suddenly it's working. Now, granted, that required some sort of regulation, but I'm not so certain it's strong government or national government. It's some regulatory body that imposes that. It could just as easily be the fishermen themselves or a state government or a fishery council. But that concept, let's take all these externalities and privatize them so people actually care to protect them and see value in them.
Let me be very clear. I think you said that I was suggesting strong and big. I didn't say big. I just said strong. And we should be very clear about this. This, again, is the ideological fixation, that the moment you talk about strong governments, you want large bureaucracies, etc. No, I just said strong. They need to stand up against vested interests. The fisheries example is a good one. I know a bit about it. But let's be very clear. The quota system failed. In Europe, too, now the quota system. But the replacement system. Someone wants to shut me up. The replacement system, can you hear me? Yeah, the replacement system is very dependent on rules and regulations enforced by governments. There is no substitute. In Europe last week, we were talking to, you know, the former head of the WTO, et cetera, and I had given the example, rather brazenly, that if you look at where technology has been really destructive, it has been in fisheries. You know, we will have technology which will hunt down the last bluefin tuna in the last stretch of the South Pacific to be able to get it as fast and quickly to a sushi bar in Hong Kong, right? And he said, it's not technology. Of course, it's not technology. But you need strong regulations that can use the other technologies to ensure that when you have allocated a piece of the ocean where you can fish, you do what you're being told to do. And I think the future of cars is the same. We will be told how many liters we can drive, how much gas we can have, and how much we'll pay in terms of carbon. The technology already exists. But you'll need a strong government to institute that. And the fisheries case, again, for years, fishery groups have lobbied against any regulation. And the European example is the best, especially the Spanish and French fleets.
Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Constance. As you were talking earlier, I was actually thinking that, especially with countries like China and India and Indonesia, where they really didn't have the opportunities to have the status symbol of what the West had for the past few decades. Now that they're really gaining the economic strength over the past couple of decades, it's inevitably that's something that they're striving for. And what I'm thinking is, on a larger level, from top down to the individual level, it is in some ways a status symbol and part of their identity to acquire that status, with consuming more, making more, producing more, more bottom line as the bottom line with everything. What are some of the viable and you know, things that are being done right now to really convey a top-down approach to governments, to the big players in the public sector and the private sector, to really buy into the idea of slowing down, maybe producing better products for everybody and for the environment, but less, and also really kind of sending the message to people that it's okay for the long run for us to pay a little bit more, okay, and not extract so much.
Yeah, I mean, when you say status symbols, I don't know what you're referring to, but let's take the car, for instance. I mean, I'm on record as saying that car ownership is not a human right. It's not in the DNA of people to have cars. That's why you have what's called the advertising industry, to tell you what you might have to aspire to be something else. The reality, though, is that that we can't aspire to live like the West. We can't. So that's the new reality for the next 50 years in this part of the world. Now, that's why I say this will be the political challenge. But the flip side, which is why I believe government should act rapidly, is this. If the population of Asia today, you take roughly, is 3.5 billion people, the true consuming classes in this part of the world are about 500 million people, right? And let's assume we carry on this sort of stripping away at the resource base, which all the science, by the way, is absolutely crystal clear, right? Crystal clear. So let's not listen to the economists. Let's listen to the science. Crystal clear. Let's assume another 500 million people do this. Meanwhile, the externalities keep being pushed aside. And that'll be a billion people. 2.5 billion people will live in a very impoverished world in the next 20 to 30 years, right? The opportunity for government to say, if that is the reality, where does our legitimacy come from? Our legitimacy comes from addressing the interests of the majority. Right now, they have bought into a system, which I've said, post-Second World War, that somehow trickle-down economics, the Washington Consensus, will save the world. It will provide enrichment for everyone. That was an economic model based out of entitlement, privilege, etc. These were people who didn't really understand the world. And so the opportunity for government to say, we can't have it all, we have to switch around, but what are the most basic rights and entitlements? Food, safe and secure. And this is going to be a huge problem, which is already out there, but you know, it's easy sitting in Hong Kong and not imagining food is a problem. It's a huge problem. Water and sanitation. As I said, more people have access to mobile phones and toilets in Asia. Second will be housing. Today, 1 in 6 people in the world live in a slum. By 2050, it'll be 1 in 3, right? So housing, 1 in 3 is going to be a key issue. And we're not talking even, you know, Hong Kong housing standards, even for the lower middle class. We're talking basics with water, sanitation. Then it'll be education and public health. Those are the things that government should aspire to deliver to their people, because that's what most people want. Not everyone is aspiring to have a flat screen TV. It's so far out of reach.
Being done to actually convince the big players in the public sector and the private sector to buy into the alternative model.
Well,
that
you know,
I totally agree with what you just said.
Yeah, but I mean, this is why policymakers need to have the discussion. As I said, you know, I don't claim that the book is going to change everything. But as far as I know, it's the first time someone in this part of the world has said, hey, you have to change this model and have a discussion. All I'm trying to do is mainstream this discussion, which has been taboo. Yeah. It's basically, you go and say this in most places, and you're an outcast. And now I'm trying to say it from a political reality rather than an environmental reality, the role of the state. What are your rights? And I think we need to redefine our rights. When I'm in Singapore, I talk about the fact that the average Singaporean sleeps, if they are upper middle class, with air conditioning. There is a reason it's warm. It's called the equator. And if you want to sleep at 19 degrees C, which is what my niece does, you've got to pay $1,000 per night for that privilege. And that's pricing. But we have absolutely denied it. And we thought this was a right. It's no more a right. So public policy needs a dramatic shift. Your question is spot on. What is being done? Few people like me and others are going around yelling and saying, get real. If we don't address this issue, I think things like the Arab Spring will look like a walk in the park, as the majority in this part of the world say, looking at their mobile phones without having a toilet and saying, how come those people in Hong Kong have this and I don't have it? I'm going to get angry.
We need to wrap up, but all this talk of mobile phones, I mean, to put it in a very difficult or sad context, did anybody get leukemia to produce your BlackBerry Bold? You and I are both using, I noticed, BlackBerry Bolds. A smartphone like an iPhone or a BlackBerry uses almost 700 rare earth-based chips. If you were using a conventional old-fashioned phone that didn't have internet, didn't have a fancy screen, it would use about 150 of those chips. Where do the rare earths come from? Malaysia, a country you know extremely well, had the last non-Chinese factory. It had so many leukemia cases in the immediate blocks around it that the villagers rioted and it had to be shut down. The production moved to China. And now the Chinese government says they don't know how to control the radioactive waste that's leaking towards the Yellow River from their own main rare earth complex. And we don't know how many leukemia cases they've got. So how do you then look at, say, your own use of phone? You obviously want it. I like my, you and I have the same model. How do you defend using for yourself something that might seem very practical but has these externalities?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. A lot of people then ask me personal questions. Oh, you travel by air. You know, you're a hypocrite. Essentially, it makes my point. Assuming you don't think I'm a 100% hypocrite, that I have some sense of commitment to this issue, then even good people like me need to be restrained. You make my point. We need rules, tough rules. I can say I don't want to use this, but you know, people like me are people. We behave badly. You make my point again. We need rules. I'll have to subscribe to those rules. But I'm no saint. Right? I live in this world, in this bubble at the moment. But I want to have that intellectual debate, but what is the true price of things? I have other things that I do, which makes me perhaps better people than some of you. You know, I don't eat meat, I've never owned a car, but this is neither here nor there. That's very personal. It's I think that trivializes the policy discussion, which is what is the price of things. And your point about pollution, that is the end of the pipe issue, right? The health effects of all of these are end of the price issues, which at some day in some time, our companies are going to be asked to, you know, through grandfather clauses, pay for sure, right? But I don't think you can ask companies to behave well. I mean, that you can't ask Pizza Hut to sell less pizzas. You can ask Pizza Hut to take out certain sort of fats, etc., through rules, but not voluntarily. You can put some public pressure on them. But if Pizza Hut sells 10 million pizzas today, I bet you they want to sell 20 million tomorrow. That's the business model. And more is not sustainable. And that the only people who can restrict more is the institutions of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. We'd like to give our guests something to remember the club by.